Thank you to all of you. Do we have questions for Francis Wood in the room? I want to start a way to ask questions of all three of them and do it. Oh, I'll think of an order, but that way we'll get a chance to hear from all three.
Right.
You don't have a mic, and this is a large room. It would be helpful. It was. Do we have some questions for her? While they're coming, I will start with a question for Mary. It says, I'm afraid your dreams will never be achieved, or maybe I'm just rejecting them because I feel they're too big. And I am unable to see how a layperson can bring this about. So where do we start, Mary?
I want to start by thanking the person for the question. I can imagine that is a common feeling for people. Can you hear me? I'll just stand up. I've got the little thing. I've got it. I think I can appreciate the person's question and the comment that I think there is a feeling sometimes that one can be overwhelmed by the enormity of the task, and especially when one is working, as it were, in the belly of the beast. I'd guess that might have been written by somebody who's an ordained minister in a church. But I must say, from where I sit in the water office, which is up over the DB's cafeteria and the special effects hair salon, in a neighborhood, which I think is the key, in a neighborhood, that it doesn't seem enormous to me at all. It seems like the daily work that we do. And it particularly doesn't seem enormous to me because I never feel alone doing it. And I think that those two things combine to make what I'm talking about exceedingly feasible and probably something that much of which we will see in our lifetime. And I say that because in the last 20 years that I've been involved in theology, I have seen enormous changes already. And I have seen my own position change as I saw it change today as Francis Wood spoke. Particularly in terms of the side on whose side or on which side is the divine. And as a person who comes out of the tradition of liberation theology and has long relied on the notion of God being on the side of the oppressed, I think Francis Wood has turned my theology around just as we sit here. So I'm very hopeful that these changes can and will come about very, very quickly with experiences like this. I thank the questioner.
Okay. Question for Mary Francis Wood. How will I change the church if they have no pulpit access? How will women change the church if they have no pulpit access?
Well,
Is this on?
You can stand up there.
Thank you. I thank the questioner, too. And it seems to me that one of the assumptions that's revealed in the question is that access to the pulpit per se is what is changing or going to change or has changed the church. And I want to argue that even in Roman Catholicism, where women are not allowed in the pulpit, in spite of its kicking and screaming, the church changes. She doesn't sit around and wait for the guys in the dresses in the Catholic tradition, the guys in the dresses and the guys in dress to get it before it changes.
That's right.
Taken out of the U.S. context, I would suggest to you, for example, that autonomy and the authority, not autonomy, the authority of subversion, where we could see an interesting case study, is not in Minneapolis, in the diocese here, Diocese of St. Paul, Minneapolis, but in Italy. Italy is where the guy in the big white dress lives and the big pointy white hat. It's the seat of power. Italy has a zero population growth. Now, we need to ask, what pulpit did the Italian women and men have to listen from? I mean, where did they hear this so that they got permission to create a zero population growth? So I guess my response is, you know, take your eye off the guy standing up there and recognize that we do that subversive activity all the time. We do life-giving and life-affirming activity all the time in spite of them, not because of them.
That's right.
Okay. I have a lot of questions for all of them, but we will not be able to hear all your questions to them, so I'm going to give them to them too so they can see the questions that you have. But this is for Susan. How does your work in the study of prostitution relate to the earlier work of Howard Moody at Judson Memorial in Greenwich Village?
I've read the Moody studies. The basic difference, or a basic difference, is of course the cross-cultural context of this. But prostitution itself has changed. The sex industry is changing very rapidly, and it is growing. It is a growth industry. Time magazine estimated that last year it was a $6 billion industry. Many things are causing this, and so I think the cross-cultural and I think the exponential increase. I mean, where do you think all of these camp survivors from Bosnia-Herzegovina have gone, friends? Do you think these Muslim communities are taking them back? They're going into brothels in Central Europe. War, particularly low-intensity warfare, a pernicious euphemism if there ever was, creates the dislocations of community, which in turn provide a tremendous workforce for the sex industry. The traffic in women that has and children, which has increased so dramatically in even the last 5 to 10 years, has greatly increased and complexified the sex industry. And I think, again, that it is very important not to assume that Western understandings of sexuality, which is, of course, part of the Moody thing, and how sexuality is constructed as work, are universals. This is not, I mean, I know it doesn't come as a surprise to this group, but Western culture is not the norm. And so it's very important to have a sense of the cross-cultural and increasingly international nature of the sex industry. It is also important to recognize that in the confines of the United States, the trafficking in women and children has also increased exponentially. Do you ever look at the milk cartons and wonder, where did all those children go? They are in forced prostitution. I do not let my boys, who are large children, go to the malls anymore, because I know that's where the pimps recruit. And I don't do it. Because children get recruited into the sex industry, they get befriended by pimps in the malls, the parents don't understand you, this is boys as well as girls, and then soon they are drugged. And the two places in the United States that have the largest numbers of forced prostitution are Las Vegas and New York. And there are many organizations working to find these children and to stop this. The best is here in Minneapolis. Stop. Speaking Truths on Prostitution. These people are saints. They do very fine work.
A question for all three of our presenters is there a brief definition of sexuality? If so, how do you define it?
Okay.
All three of you. You can.
I will hazard a short answer to that. No. No, there is not. I did want to argue that I presented Trong's definition of prostitution here. I had left it out to shorten my address, and Mary's pointing out the need to talk about economics. Trong defines prostitution is to be understood as a female strategy for survival under the conditions of poverty. But I would say no, there is not, from my perspective, okay. No, it is not a short answer.
The other two? Francis or Mary?
I'll say yes. I think there is a short definition, and I learned this from my friend Marilyn Thee, which is at Colgate University. She talks about sexuality as embodied energy. Yeah, embodied energy. And I like that a lot. Embodied energy.
And I'm going to say yes and no. True to form.
We got the yes.
Yes,
on
that
the
was
record.
One of the questions, Francis. Somebody wanted to know what you were saying yes to up here.
My yes and no. Notice how I skillfully and graciously smiled at Nadine and turned away. My yes and no has to do with the no has to do with this T, making it a T, a sexuality, is a Western construct. Thank you, Susan.
You are. Thank Michelle Foucault.
Thank you, Michelle, wherever you have gone on to. It is a construct that has to do with needing to make a science out of whatever it is that has to do with our lives. Mm-hmm. And so when we have sexuality, then we've got a box to put sex in. Yeah. So and that's problematic for a number of reasons. It is part of that orgy of alienation, which was a phrase that I love today. So that's the no. There is no such thing. The yes part would resound with Mary, and it is a part of being a human being. It is the bodily expression. It is the soul expression. It is. I can't separate it any more than I can separate out the way I breathe, the way my skin flakes off in the shower. It is sum and substance of who we are. And our problem with it in Western Christian identification is we've tried to put it in some little box somewhere. And a not very nice box, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. So the answer is no and yes. There is no such thing. And yes, there is. It is who I am. It's who you are. It's who we are.
You wanted to add
anything? I just wanted to add a short story to this. I was at a conference one time with a bunch of theologians, male and female, and one of the men was discoursing on sexuality. And one of the women turned to me, a woman who will remain nameless, but whose initials are Rosemary Radford Ruther. And Rosemary turned to me, and I miss Rosemary here this weekend because I'm sure she'd be adding to this conversation. She had a lot to say. She turned to me and she said, "How can they make something that's so warm and wet seem so cold and dry?" That was to me the essence of sexuality.
We are going to have to wrap it up. Is that right, Judy? To this point.
I think
thank our presenters.